Chapter 38. Luther Burbank, A Saint Amid the Roses. The secret of improved plant breeding, apart from scientific knowledge, is love. Luther Burbank uttered this wisdom as I walked beside him in his garden in Santa Rosa, California. We halted near a bed of edible cacti. While I was conducting experiments to make spineless cacti, he continued, I often talked to the plants to create a vibration of love. You have nothing to fear, I would tell them. You don't need your defensive thorns. I will protect you. Gradually, the useful plant of the desert emerged in a thornless variety. I was charmed at this miracle. Please, dear Luther, give me a few cactus leaves to plant in my garden at Mount Washington. A workman standing nearby started to strip off some leaves. Burbank prevented him. I myself will pluck them for the Swami. He handed me three leaves, which later I planted, rejoicing as they grew to huge estate. The great horticulturalist told me that his first notable triumph was the large potato now known by his name. With the indefatigability of genius, he went on to present the world with hundreds of crossed improvements on nature. His new Burbank varieties of tomato, corn, squash, cherries, plums, nectarines, berries, poppies, lilies, roses. I focused my camera as Luther led me before the famous walnut tree by which he has proved that natural evolution can be telescopically hastened. In only 16 years, he said, this walnut tree reached a state of abundant nut production. Unaided nature would have required twice that time. Burbank's little adopted daughter came romping with her dog into the garden. She's my human plant. Luther waved to her affectionately. I see humanity now as one vast plant, needing for its highest fulfillments only love, the natural blessings of the great outdoors, and intelligent crossing and selection. In the span of my own lifetime, I have observed such wondrous progress in plant evolution that I look forward optimistically to a healthy, happy world as soon as its children are taught the principles of simple and rational living. We must return to nature and nature's God. Luther, you would delight in my ranchy school, with its outdoor classes, an atmosphere of joy and simplicity. My words touched the chord closest to Burbank's heart. Child education. He plied me with questions, interest gleaming from his deep, serene eyes. Swamiji, he said finally, schools like yours are the only hope of a future millennium. I am in revolt against the educational systems of our time, severed from nature and stifling of all individuality. I am with you heart and soul in your practical ideals of education. As I was taking leave of the gentle sage, he autographed a small volume and presented it to me. Here is my book on the training of the human plant, he said. New types of training are needed. Fearless experiments. At times, the most daring trials have succeeded in bringing out the best in fruits and flowers. Educational innovations for children should likewise become more numerous, more courageous. I read his little book that night with intense interest. His eyes envisioning a glorious future for the race, he wrote, the most stubborn living thing in this world, the most difficult to swerve, is a plant once fixed in certain habits. Remember that this plant has preserved its individuality all through the ages. Perhaps it is one which can be traced backward through eons of time in the very rocks themselves, never having varied to any great extent in all these vast periods. Do you suppose, after all these ages of repetition, the plant does not become possessed of a will, if you so choose to call it, of unparalleled tenacity? Indeed, there are plants, like certain of the palms, so persistent that no human power has yet been able to change them. The human will is a weak thing beside the will of a plant. But see how this whole plant's lifelong stubbornness is broken simply by blending a new life with it, making, by crossing, a complete and powerful change in its life. Then, when the break comes, fix it by these generations of patient supervision and selection. And the new plant sets out upon its new way, never again to return to the old, its tenacious will broken and changed at last. When it comes to so sensitive and pliable a thing as the nature of a child, the problem becomes vastly easier. Magnetically drawn to this great American, I visited him again and again. One morning, I arrived at the same time as the postman, who deposited in Burbank's study about 1,000 letters. Horticulturalists wrote him from all parts of the world. "Swamiji, your presence is just the excuse I need to get out into the garden," Luther said gaily. He opened a large desk drawer containing hundreds of travel folders. "See," he said, "this is how I do my travelling. Tied down by my plants and correspondence, I satisfy my desire for foreign lands by a glance now and then at these pictures." My car was standing before his gate. Luther and I drove along the streets of the little town, its gardens bright with his own varieties of Santa Rosa, Peachblow, and Burbank roses. The great scientist had received Kriya initiation during one of my earlier visits. "I practiced the technique devoutly, Swamiji," he said. After many thoughtful questions to me about various aspects of yoga, Luther remarked slowly, "The East, indeed, possesses immense hoards of knowledge that the West has scarcely begun to explore." Intimate communion with nature, who unlocked to him many of her jealously guarded secrets, had given Burbank a boundless spiritual reverence. "Sometimes I feel very close to the infinite power," he confided shyly, his sensitive, beautifully modelled face lit with his memories. "Then I have been able to heal sick persons around me, as well as many ailing plants." He told me of his mother, a sincere Christian. "Many times since her death," Luther said, "I have been blessed by her appearance in visions. She has spoken to me." We drove back reluctantly towards his home and those waiting 1,000 letters. "Luther," I remarked, "next month I'm starting a magazine to present the truth offerings of East and West. Please help me decide on a good name for the journal." We discussed titles for a while and finally agreed on East West. After we had re-entered his study, Burbank gave me an article he'd written on science and civilization. "This will go in the first issue of East West," I said gratefully. As our friendship grew deeper, I called Burbank my American saint. "Behold a man," I paraphrased, "in whom is no guile." His heart was fathomlessly deep, long acquainted with humility, patience, sacrifice. His little home amid the roses was austerely simple. He knew the worthlessness of luxury, the joy of few possessions. The modesty with which he wore his scientific fame repeatedly reminded me of the trees that bend low with the burden of ripening fruits. "It is the barren tree that lifts its head high in an empty boast." I was in New York when, in 1926, my dear friend passed away. In tears I thought, "Oh, I would gladly walk all the way from here to Santa Rosa for one more glimpse of him." Locking myself away from secretaries and visitors, I spent the next 24 hours in seclusion. The following day, I conducted a Vedic memorial rite before a large picture of Luther. A group of my American students, garbed in Hindu ceremonial clothes, chanted the ancient hymns as an offering was made of flowers, water, and fire, symbols of the bodily elements and their return to the infinite source. Though the form of Burbank lies in Santa Rosa, under a Lebanon cedar that he planted years ago in his garden, his soul is enshrined for me in every wide-eyed flower that blooms by the wayside. Withdrawn for a time into the spacious spirit of nature, is that not Luther whispering in her winds, walking her dawns? His name has now passed into the heritage of common speech. listing Burbank as a transitive verb. Webster's New International Dictionary defines it to cross or graft a plant. Hence, figuratively, to improve anything as a process or institution by selecting good features and rejecting bad, or by adding good features. Beloved Burbank, I cried after reading the definition, your very name is now a synonym for goodness. Reproduced here is a letter from Luther Burbank, Santa Rosa, California, USA, December 22, 1924. I have examined the Yogoda system of Swami Yogananda, and in my opinion, it is ideal for training and harmonizing man's physical, mental, and spiritual natures. Swami's aim is to establish how-to-live schools throughout the world, wherein education will not confine itself to intellectual development alone, but also training of the body, will, and feelings. Through the Yogoda system of physical, mental, and spiritual unfoldment, by simple and scientific methods of concentration and meditation, most of the complex problems of life may be solved, and peace and goodwill come upon earth. The Swami's idea of right education is plain common sense, free from all mysticism and non-practicality. Otherwise, it would not have my approval. I am glad to have this opportunity of heartily joining with the Swami in his appeal for international schools on the art of living, which, if established, will come as near to bringing the millennium as anything with which I am acquainted. Signed, Luther Burbank. Chapter 39. Therese Neumann, the Catholic Stigmatist. Return to India. I have waited for you patiently for 15 years. Soon I shall swim out of the body and onto the shining abode. Yogananda, come. Sri Yukteswar's voice sounded startlingly in my inner ear as I sat in meditation at my Mount Washington headquarters. Traversing 10,000 miles in the twinkling of an eye, his message penetrated my being like a flash of lightning. 15 years. Yes, I realized. Now it is 1935. I have spent 15 years in spreading my guru's teaching in America. Now he recalls me. A short time later, I described my experience to a dear friend, Mr. James J. Lynn. His spiritual development by daily practice of Kriya Yoga has been so remarkable that I often call him Saint Lynn. In him, and in a number of other Occidentals, I happily see a fulfillment of Babaji's prophecy that the West, too, would produce saints of true self-realization through the ancient yogic path. Mr. Lin generously insisted on making a donation for my travels. The financial problem thus solved, I made arrangements to sail, via Europe, for India. In March 1935, I had Self-Realization Fellowship chartered under the laws of the state of California as a non-sectarian, non-profit corporation, designed to exist perpetually. To Self-Realization Fellowship, I donated all my possessions, including the rights in all my writings. Like most other religious and educational institutions, Self-Realization Fellowship is supported by endowments and donations from its members and the public. I shall be back, I told my students. Never shall I forget America. At a farewell banquet given to me in Los Angeles by loving friends, I looked long at their faces and thought gratefully, Lord, he who remembers thee as the sole giver will never lack the sweetness of friendship among mortals. I sailed from New York on June 9, 1935, on the Europa. Two students accompanied me, my secretary, Mr. C. Richard Wright, and an elderly lady from Cincinnati, Miss Etty Bletch. We enjoyed the days of ocean peace, a welcome contrast to the past hurried weeks. Our period of leisure was short-lived. The speed of modern boats has some regrettable features. Like any other group of inquisitive tourists, we walked about the huge and ancient city of London. On the day following my arrival, I was invited to address a large meeting in Caxton Hall, at which I was introduced to the London audience by Sir Francis Younghusband. Our party spent a pleasant day as guests of Sir Harry Lauder at his estate in Scotland. A few days later, our little group crossed the English Channel to the continent, for I wanted to make a pilgrimage to Bavaria. This would be my only chance, I felt, to visit the great Catholic mystic, Theresa Neumann of Connersreuth. Years earlier, I had read an amazing account of Theresa. Information given in the article was as follows. 1. Theresa, born on Good Friday in 1898, was injured in an accident at the age of 20. She became blind and paralyzed. 2. She miraculously regained her sight in 1923 through prayers to Saint Theresa of Lisieux, the Little Flower. Later, Theresa Neumann's limbs were instantaneously healed. 3. From 1923 onward, Theresa has abstained completely from food and drink, except for the daily swallowing of one small consecrated wafer. 4. The Stigmata, Sacred Wounds of Christ, appeared in 1926 on Theresa's head, breast, hands, and feet. Every Friday, she experiences the Passion of Christ, suffering in her own body all his historic agonies. 5. Knowing ordinarily only the simple German of her village, during her Friday trances, Theresa utters phrases which scholars have identified as ancient Aramaic. At appropriate times in her vision, she speaks Hebrew or Greek. 6. By ecclesiastical permission, Theresa has several times been under close scientific observation. Dr. Fritz Gerlich, editor of a Protestant German newspaper, went to Connersreuth to expose the Catholic fraud, but ended up by reverently writing her biography. As always, whether in East or West, I was eager to meet a saint. I rejoiced as our little party entered, on July 16th, the quaint village of Connersreuth. The Bavarian peasants exhibited lively interest in our Ford automobile, brought with us from America, and its assorted group. An American young man, an elderly lady, and an olive-hued Oriental with long hair tucked under his coat collar. Theresa's little cottage, clean and neat, with geraniums blooming by a primitive well, was, alas, silently closed. The neighbours, and even the village postman who passed by, could give us no information. Rain began to fall. My companions suggested that we leave. "No," I said stubbornly, "I will stay here until I find some clue leading to Theresa." 2 hours later, we were still sitting in our car amidst the dismal rain. "Lord," I sighed complainingly, "why didst thou lead me here if she has disappeared?" An English-speaking man halted beside us, politely offering his aid. "I don't know for certain where Theresa is," he said, "but she often visits at the home of Professor Franz Wutz, a teacher of foreign languages at the University of Eichstätt, 80 miles from here." The following morning, our party motored to the quiet town of Eichstätt. Dr. Wutz greeted us cordially at his home. "Yes, Theresa is here." He sent her word of the visitors. A messenger soon appeared with her reply. "Though the bishop has asked me to see no one without his permission, I will receive the man of God from India." Deeply touched at these words, I followed Dr. Wutz upstairs to the sitting room. Theresa entered immediately, radiating an aura of peace and joy. She wore a black gown and spotless white headdress. Although her age was 37 at this time, she seemed much younger, possessing indeed a childlike freshness and charm. Healthy, well-formed, rosy-cheeked and cheerful, this is the saint who does not eat. Theresa greeted me with a very gentle handshaking, we beamed in silent communion, each knowing the other to be a lover of God. Dr. Wutz kindly offered to serve as interpreter. As we seated ourselves, I noticed that Teresa was glancing at me with naive curiosity. Evidently Hindus had been rare in Bavaria. "Don't you eat anything?" I wanted to hear the answer from her own lips. "No, except a host, at 6 o'clock each morning." "How large is the host?" "It is paper thin, the size of a small coin," she added. "I take it for sacramental reasons. If it is unconsecrated, I am unable to swallow it." "Certainly, you could not have lived on that for 12 whole years. "I live by God's light." How simple her reply, how Einsteinian. "I see you realize that energy flows to your body from the ether, sun, and air." A swift smile broke over her face. "I'm so happy to know you understand how I live." "Your sacred life is a daily demonstration of the truth uttered by Christ. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God." Again she showed joy at my explanation. "It is indeed so. One of the reasons I am here on earth today is to prove that man can live by God's invisible light, and not by food only." "Can you teach others how to live without food?" She appeared a trifle shocked. "I cannot do that. God does not wish it." As my gaze fell on her strong, graceful hands, Teresa showed me a square, freshly healed wound on the back of each hand. On the palm of each hand, she pointed out a smaller, crescent-shaped wound, freshly healed. Each wound went straight through the hand. The sight brought to me a distinct recollection of the large, square iron nails with crescent-tipped ends that are still used in the East, but that I do not recall having seen in the West. The saint told me something of her weekly trances. As a helpless onlooker, I observe the whole passion of Christ. Each week, from Thursday midnight until Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock, her wounds open and bleed. She loses 10 pounds of her ordinary 121-pound weight. Suffering intensely in her sympathetic love, Teresa yet looks forward joyously to these weekly visions of her Lord. I realized at once that her strange life is intended by God to reassure all Christians of the historical authenticity of Jesus' life and crucifixion as recorded in the New Testament, and to display dramatically the ever-living bond between the Galilean master and his devotees. Professor Wutz related some of his experiences with the saint. "A group of us, including Teresa, often travel for days on sightseeing trips in Germany," he told me. "It is a striking contrast. Teresa eats nothing. The rest of us have 3 meals a day. She remains as fresh as a rose, untouched by fatigue. Whenever the rest of us get hungry and look for wayside inns, Teresa laughs merrily." The professor added some interesting physiological details. "Because Teresa takes no food, her stomach has shrunk. She has no excretions, but her perspiration glands function. Her skin is always soft and firm." At the time of parting, I expressed to Teresa my desire to be present at her trance. "Yes, please come to Konnersreuth next Friday," she said graciously. "The bishop will give you a permit. I'm very happy you sought me out in Eichstätt." Teresa shook hands gently many times and walked with our party to the gate. Mr. Wright turned on the automobile radio. The saint examined it with little enthusiastic chuckles. Such a large crowd of youngsters gathered that Teresa retreated into the house. We saw her at the window, where she peered at us, childlike, waving her hand. From a conversation the next day with two of Teresa's brothers, very kind and amiable, we learned that the saint sleeps only 1 or 2 hours at night. In spite of the many wounds in her body, she's active and full of energy. She loves birds, looks after an aquarium of fish, and works often in her garden. Her correspondence is large. Catholic devotees write her for prayers and healing blessings. Many seekers have been cured through her of serious diseases. Her brother, Ferdinand, about 23, explained that Teresa has the power, through prayer, of working out on her own body the ailments of others. The saint's abstinence from food dates from a time when she prayed that the throat disease of a young man of her parish, then preparing to enter holy orders, be transferred to her own throat. On Thursday afternoon, our party drove to the home of the bishop, who looked at my flowing locks with some surprise. He readily wrote out the necessary permit. There was no fee. The rule made by the church is simply to protect Teresa from the onrush of casual tourists, who in previous years had flocked by thousands to Konnersreuth on Fridays. We arrived in the village on Friday morning about 9:30. I noticed that Teresa's little cottage possesses a glass-roofed section to afford her plenty of light. We were glad to see the doors no longer closed, but wide open in hospitable cheer. We joined a line of about 20 visitors, each carrying a permit. Many had come from great distances to view the mystic trance. Teresa had passed my first test at the professor's house by her intuitive knowledge that I wanted to see her for spiritual reasons, and not just to satisfy a passing curiosity. My second test was connected with the fact that, just before I went upstairs to her room, I put myself into a yogic trance state in order to attain telepathic and televisional rapport with her. I entered her chamber, filled with visitors. She was lying in a white robe on the bed, with Mr. Wright close behind me. I halted just inside the threshold, awestruck at a strange and most frightful spectacle. Blood flowed thinly and continuously in an inch-wide stream from Teresa's lower eyelids. Her gaze was focused upwards on the spiritual eye within the central forehead. The cloth wrapped around her head was drenched in blood from the stigmata wounds of the crown of thorns. The white garment was redly splotched over her heart from the wound in her side at the spot where Christ's body, long ages ago, had suffered the final indignity of the soldier's spear thrust. Teresa's hands were extended in a gesture maternal, pleading. Her face wore an expression both tortured and divine. She appeared thinner and was subtly changed in many inner and outer ways. Murmuring words in a foreign tongue, she spoke with slightly quivering lips to persons who were visible to her superconscious sight. As I was in attunement with her, I began to see the scenes of her vision. She was watching Jesus as he carried the timbers of the cross amid the jeering multitude. Suddenly she lifted her head in consternation. The Lord had fallen under the cruel weight. The vision disappeared. In the exhaustion of fervid pity, Teresa sank heavily against her pillow. At this moment, I heard a loud thud behind me. Turning my head for a second, I saw two men carrying out a prostrate body. But because I was coming out of the deep superconscious state, I did not immediately recognize the fallen person. Again, I fixed my eyes on Teresa's face, deathly pale under the rivulets of blood, but now calm, radiating purity and holiness. I glanced behind me later and saw Mr. Wright standing with his hand against his cheek, from which blood was trickling. "Dick," I inquired anxiously, "were you the one who fell?" "Yes," I fainted at the terrifying spectacle. "Well," I said consolingly, "you are brave to return and look upon the sight again." Remembering the patiently waiting line of pilgrims, Mr. Wright and I silently bade farewell to Teresa and left her sacred presence. The following day, our little group motored south, thankful that we were not dependent on trains, but could stop the ford wherever we chose throughout the countryside. We enjoyed every minute of a tour through Germany, Holland, France, and the Swiss Alps. In Italy, we made a special trip to Assisi to honour the Apostle of Humility, St. Francis. The European tour ended in Greece, where we viewed the Athenian temples and saw the prison in which the gentle Socrates had drunk his death potion. One is filled with admiration for the artistry with which the ancient Greeks everywhere wrought their very fancies in alabaster. We took ship over the sunny Mediterranean, disembarking at Palestine. Wandering day after day over the Holy Land, I was more than ever convinced of the value of pilgrimage. To the sensitive heart, the Spirit of Christ is all-pervasive in Palestine. I walked reverently by his side at Bethlehem, Gethsemane, Calvary, the Holy Mount of Olives, and by the River Jordan and the Sea of Galilee. Our little party visited the birth manger, Joseph's carpenter shop, the tomb of Lazarus, the house of Martha and Mary, the hall of the Last Supper. Antiquity unfolded scene by scene, I saw the divine drama that Christ once played for the ages. On to Egypt, with its modern Cairo and ancient pyramids, and then a boat down the long Red Sea, over the vast Arabian Sea, lo, India. Chapter 40. I return to India. Gratefully, I was inhaling the blessed air of India. Our boat, Rajputana, docked on August 22, 1935, in the huge harbour of Bombay. Even this, my first day off the ship, was a foretaste of the ceaselessly busy year ahead. Friends had gathered at the dock to welcome us with flower garlands. Soon, at our suite in the Taj Mahal Hotel, we received several groups of reporters and photographers. Bombay was a city new to me. I found it energetically modern, with many innovations from the West. Palms line the spacious boulevards. Magnificent state structures vie for interest with the ancient temples. Very little time was given to sightseeing, however. I was impatient, eager to see my beloved guru and other dear ones. Consigning the four to a baggage car, our party was soon speeding eastward by train toward Calcutta. Our arrival at Howrah station found such an immense crowd assembled to greet us that for a while we were unable to disembark from the train. The young Maharaja of Kasim Bazaar and my brother Bishnu headed the reception committee. I was unprepared for the warmth and magnitude of our welcome. Preceded by a line of automobiles and motorcycles, and amidst the joyous sounds of drums and conches, Miss Bletch, Mr. Wright and I, flower garlanded from head to foot, drove slowly to my father's home. My aged parent embraced me as one returning from the dead. Long we gazed on each other, speechless with joy. Brothers and sisters, uncles, aunts and cousins, students and friends of years long past were grouped around me, not a dry eye among us. Passed now into the archives of memory, the scene of loving reunion vividly endures, unforgettable in my heart. As for my meeting with Sri Yukteswar, words fail me. Let the following description from my secretary suffice. Today, filled with the highest anticipations, I drove Yoganandaji from Calcutta to Serampore, Mr. Wright recorded in his travel diary. We passed by quaint shops, one of them the favourite eating place of Yoganandaji during his college days, and finally entered a narrow, walled lane. A sudden left turn, and there before us stood the two-storey brick ashram of the master, its grilled balcony jutting from the upper floor. The pervasive impression was that of peaceful solitude. In grave humility, I walked behind Yoganandaji into the courtyard within the hermitage walls. Hearts beating fast, we proceeded up some old cement steps, trod, no doubt, by countless truth-seekers. Our tension grew keener and keener as on we strode. Before us, near the head of the stairs, quietly appeared the Great One, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, standing in the noble pose of a sage. My heart heaved and swelled at the blessing of being in his sublime presence. Tears blurred my eager sight when Yoganandaji dropped to his knees, and with bowed head offered his soul's gratitude and greeting. Touching with his hands the Guru's feet and then in humble obeisance his own forehead, he rose and then was embraced on both sides on the bosom by Sri Yukteswarji. No words passed in the beginning, but intense feeling was expressed in the mute phrases of the soul. How their eyes sparkled with the warmth of reunion. A tender vibration surged through the quiet patio, and the sun suddenly eluded the clouds to add a blaze of glory. On bended knee before the master, I gave my own unexpressed love and thanks, touching his feet, calloused by time and service, and receiving his blessing. I stood then and gazed into his beautiful eyes, deep with introspection, yet radiant with joy. We entered his sitting room, whose whole side opens to the balcony first seen from the street. The master sat on a covered mattress placed on the cement floor, bracing himself against a worn davenport. Yoganandaji and I sat near the Guru's feet, with orange-coloured pillows to lean against and to ease our positions on the straw mat. I tried without much success to understand the gist of the talk in Bengali between the two Swamijis, for they do not use English, I discovered, when they are together. Although Swamiji Maharaj, as the great Guru is called by others, can and often does speak it. But I easily perceived the saintliness of the Great One through his heart-warming smile and twinkling eyes. Quickly discernible in his merry or serious conversation is a positiveness in statement, the mark of a sage, one who knows he knows, because he knows God. The Master's great wisdom, strength of purpose, and determination are apparent in every way. He was simply clad, his dhoti and shirt, once dyed an ochre colour, are now a faded orange. Studying him reverently from time to time, I noted that he is of large, athletic stature, his body hardened by the trials and sacrifices of a renunciant's life. His poise is majestic. He moves with dignified tread and erect posture. A jovial and rollicking laugh comes from the depths of his chest, causing his whole body to shake and quiver. His austere face strikingly conveys an impression of divine power. His hair, parted in the middle, is white around the forehead, streaked elsewhere with silvery gold and silvery black, and ends in ringlets at his shoulders. His beard and moustache are scant or thinned out, and seem to enhance his features. His forehead slopes as though seeking the heavens. His dark eyes are haloed by an ethereal blue ring. He has a rather large and homely nose, with which he amuses himself in idle moments, flipping and wiggling it with his fingers, like a child. In repose his mouth is stern, yet subtly touched with tenderness. Glancing here and there, I observed that the somewhat dilapidated room suggests the owner's non-attachment to material comforts. The weather-stained white walls of the long chamber are streaked with fading blue plaster. At one end of the room hangs the unique picture of Lahiri Mahashaya, devotionally adorned with a simple garland. There is also an old photograph showing Yoganandaji at the time of his arrival in Boston, standing with other delegates to the Congress of Religions. I noted a quaint concurrence of old and new. A huge cut-glass candlelight chandelier is covered with cobwebs through long disuse, and on the wall hangs a bright up-to-date calendar. The room emanates a fragrance of peace and happiness. Beyond the balcony, coconut palms tower over the hermitage as though in silent protection. The master needs merely to clap his hands. Before finishing, he is attended by some small disciple. One of them, a thin lad named Prafulla, has long black hair, sparkling black eyes, and a heavenly smile. His eyes twinkle as the corners of his mouth rise, like stars and a crescent moon suddenly appearing at twilight. Swami Sri Yukteswarji's joy is obviously intense at the return of his product, and he seems to be somewhat inquisitive about me, the product's product. However, the predominance of wisdom in the Great One's nature hinders his outward expression of feeling. Yoganandaji presented him with some gifts, as is the custom when a disciple returns to his guru. We sat down later to a simple but well-cooked meal of vegetables and rice. Sri Yukteswarji was pleased at my observance of a number of Indian customs, finger-eating, for example. After several hours of flying Bengali phrases and the exchange of warm smiles and joyful glances, we paid obeisance at his feet, bade adieu with a pranam, and departed for Calcutta with an everlasting memory of a sacred meeting. Although I write chiefly of my external impressions of the Master, yet I was always conscious of his spiritual glory. I felt his power, and shall ever retain that feeling as my divine blessing. From America, Europe, and Palestine, I had brought many presents for Sri Yukteswar. He received them smilingly, but without remark. For my own use, I had bought in Germany a combination umbrella cane. In India, I decided to give the cane to Master. This gift I appreciate indeed. My guru's eyes were turned on me with affectionate understanding as he made the unwanted comment. From all the presents, it was the cane that he singled out to display to visitors. Master, please permit me to get a new carpet for the sitting room. I had noticed that Sri Yukteswar's tiger skin was placed over a torn rug. Do so, if it pleases you. My guru's voice was not enthusiastic. Behold, my tiger mat is nice and clean. I'm a monarch in my own little kingdom. Beyond it is the vast world, interested only in externals. As he uttered these words, I felt the years roll back. Once again, I'm a young disciple, purified daily in fires of chastisement. As soon as I could tear myself away from Serampore and Calcutta, I set out with Mr. Wright for Ranchi. What a welcome there, a touching ovation. Tears stood in my eyes as I embraced the selfless teachers who had kept the banner of the school flying during my 15 years' absence. The bright faces and happy smiles of the residential and day students were ample testimony to the worth of their careful school and yoga training. Yet, alas, the Ranchi institution was in dire financial difficulties. Sir Manindra Chandra Nundi, the old Maharaja whose Kasimbazar palace had been converted into the central school building and who had made many princely donations, was now dead. Many free, benevolent features of the school were seriously endangered for lack of sufficient public support. I had not spent years in America without learning some of its practical wisdom, its undaunted spirit before obstacles. For 1 week I remained in Ranchi, wrestling with critical problems. Then came interviews in Calcutta with prominent leaders and educators, a long talk with the young Maharaja of Kasimbazar, a financial appeal to my father, and lo, the shaky foundations of the Ranchi school began to be righted. Many donations arrived in the nick of time from my American students. Within a few months after my arrival in India, I had the joy of seeing the Ranchi school legally incorporated. My lifelong dream of a permanently endowed yoga educational center was fulfilled. That aspiration had guided me in the humble beginnings in 1917 with a group of 7 boys. The school, Yogoda Satsanga Brahmacharya Vidyalaya, conducts outdoor classes in grammar and high school subjects. The resident students and day scholars also receive vocational training of some kind. The boys themselves regulate many of their activities through autonomous committees. Very early in my career as an educator, I discover that boys who may impishly delight in outwitting a teacher will cheerfully accept disciplinary rules that are set by their fellow students. Never a model pupil myself, I had a ready sympathy for all boyish pranks and problems. Sports and games are encouraged. The fields resound with hockey and football practice. Ranchi students often win the cup at competitive events. The boys are taught the Yagoda method of muscle recharging through willpower, mental direction of life energy to any part of the body. They also learn asanas, postures, and sword and lati, stick play. Trained in first aid, the Ranchi students have given praiseworthy service to their province in tragic times of flood or famine. The boys work in the garden and grow their own vegetables. Instruction in Hindi in primary school subjects is provided for Koles, Santals and Mundas, Aboriginal tribes of the province. Classes for girls only are conducted in nearby villages. The unique feature at Ranchi is the initiation into Kriya Yoga. The boys daily practice their spiritual exercises, engage in Gita chanting, and are taught by precept and example the virtues of simplicity, self-sacrifice, honour, and truth. Evil is pointed out to them as being that which produces misery, good as those actions which result in true happiness. Evil may be compared to poisoned honey, tempting but laden with death. Overcoming restlessness of body and mind by concentration techniques has achieved astonishing results. It is no novelty at Ranchi to see an appealing little figure, aged 9 or 10 years, sitting for an hour or more in unbroken poise, the unwinking gaze directed to the spiritual eye. In the orchard stands a Shiva temple with a statue of the Blessed Master, Lahiri Mahashai. Daily prayers and scripture classes are held in the garden under the mango bowers. Yagoda Satsanga Sevashram, Home of Service Hospital, on the Ranchi estate, offers free surgical and medical aid to many thousands of India's poor. Ranchi lies 2,000 feet above sea level. The climate is mild and equable. The 25-acre site, by a large bathing pond, includes one of the finest private orchards in India. 500 fruit trees, mango, date, guava, lychee, jackfruit. The Ranchi Library contains numerous magazines and 1,000 volumes in English and Bengali, donations from the West and the East. There is a collection of the scriptures of the world. A well-classified museum displays precious stones and archaeological, geological, and anthropological exhibits. Trophies, to a great extent, from my wanderings over the Lord's varied earth. Branch high schools, with the residential and yoga features of Ranchi, have been opened and are now flourishing. These are Yagoda Satsanga Vidyapith School for boys at Lakhanpur in West Bengal and the High School and Hermitage at Ejmalichak in Midnapur, Bengal. A stately Yagoda Math Ashram in Dakshineshwar, fronting the Ganges, was dedicated in 1939. Only a few miles north of Calcutta, the hermitage affords a haven of peace for city dwellers. The Dakshineshwar Math is the headquarters in India of Yagoda Satsanga Society and its schools, centres and hermitages in various parts of India. Yagoda Satsanga Society of India is legally affiliated with the international headquarters, Self-Realization Fellowship in Los Angeles, California, USA. Yagoda Satsanga activities include publication of the quarterly Yagoda magazine and fortnightly mailings of lessons to students in all parts of India. These lessons give detailed instruction in the Self-Realization Fellowship energization, concentration, and meditation techniques. Their faithful practice constitutes the essential groundwork for the higher instruction in Kriya Yoga, which is given in subsequent lessons to qualified students. Yagoda educational, religious, and humanitarian activities require the service and devotion of many teachers and workers. I do not list their names here because they are so numerous, but in my heart each one has a lustrous niche. Mr. Wright formed many friendships with Ranchi boys. Clad in simple dhoti, he lived for a while among them. In Bombay, Ranchi, Calcutta, Serampore, everywhere he went, my secretary, who has a gift of vivid description, would write in a travel diary his adventures. One evening, I asked him a question. "Dick, what is your impression of India?" "Peace," he said thoughtfully. "The racial aura is peace." Chapter 41. An Idyll in South India. You are the first Westerner, Dick, ever to enter that shrine. Many others have tried in vain. At my words, Mr. Wright looked startled, then pleased. We had just left the beautiful Chamundi Temple in the hills overlooking Mysore in southern India. There we had bowed before the gold and silver altars of the goddess Chamundi, patron deity of the Mysore ruling family. As a souvenir of the unique honour, Mr. Wright said, carefully wrapping a few rose petals, I will always preserve these petals, blessed by the priest with rose water. My companion and I were spending the month of November 1935 as guests of the state of Mysore. Miss Bletch had remained behind with my relatives in Calcutta. The Maharaja's heir, His Highness the Yuvaraja, Sri Kantirava Narasimha Raja Wadiyar, had invited my secretary and me to visit his enlightened and progressive realm. During the past fortnight, I had addressed thousands of citizens and students in Mysore City at the Town Hall, the Maharaja's College, the University Medical School, and three mass meetings in Bangalore at the National High School, the Intermediate College, and Chetty Town Hall, in which 3,000 persons had assembled. Whether the eager listeners had been able to credit the glowing picture I drew of America, I know not, but the applause had always been loudest when I spoke of the mutual benefits to be derived from exchange of the best features of East and West. Mr. Wright and I were now relaxing in the tropical peace. His travel diary contains the following account of his impressions of Mysore. Many rapturous moments had been spent in gazing, almost absent-mindedly, at the ever-changing canvas of God stretched across the firmament, for his touch alone is able to produce colours that vibrate with the freshness of life. That youth of colours is lost when man tries to imitate with mere pigments, for the Lord resorts to a more simple and effective medium, neither oils nor pigments, but mere rays of light. He tosses a splash of light here, and it reflects red. He waves the brush again, and the colour blends gradually into orange and gold. Then, with a piercing thrust, he stabs the clouds with a streak of purple that leaves a ringlet or fringe of red oozing out of the wound. And so, on and on, he plays, night and morning alike, ever-changing, ever-new, ever-fresh, no duplicates, no patterns or colours, just the same. The beauty of the change in India from day to night, and from night to day, is beyond compare elsewhere. Often the sky looks as if God had taken all the colours in his kit and had given them one mighty kaleidoscopic toss into the heavens. I must relate the splendour of a twilight visit to the huge Krishnaraja Sagar Dam, 12 miles outside Mysore City. Yoganandaji and I boarded a small bus and, with a small boy's official cranker or battery substitute, started over a smooth dirt road just as the sun was setting, squashing on the horizon like an overripe tomato. Our journey led past the ever-present square rice fields through a grove of comforting banyan trees in between towering coconut palms. Nearly everywhere vegetation was thick as in a jungle. Approaching the crest of a hill, we beheld an immense artificial lake, reflecting the stars and a fringe of palms and other trees, surrounded by lovely terraced gardens and rows of electric lights. Below the brink of the dam, we saw a dazzling spectacle, coloured beams playing on geyser-like fountains that resembled outpourings of brilliant inks, gorgeous blue, red, green, and yellow waterfalls, and majestic stone elephants spouting water. The dam, whose lighted fountains reminded me of those at the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago, is modernly outstanding in this ancient land of paddy fields and simple people. The Indians have given us such a loving welcome that I fear it will take more than my strength to bring Yoganandaji back to America. Another rare privilege, my first elephant ride. Yesterday the Yuvaraja invited us to his summer palace to enjoy a ride on one of his elephants, an enormous beast. I mounted a ladder provided to climb aloft to the howdah, or saddle, which is silk-cushioned and box-like, and then for a rolling, tossing, heaving, and swaying down into a gully, too much thrilled to worry or exclaim, but hanging on for dear life. Southern India, rich with historical and archaeological remains, is a land of definite and yet indefinable charm. To the north of Mysore is Hyderabad, a picturesque plateau cut by the mighty Godavari River. Broad, fertile plains, the lovely Nilgiris or Blue Mountains, other areas with barren hills of limestone or granite. Hyderabad history is a long, colourful story, starting 3,000 years ago under the Andhra kings and continuing under Hindu dynasties until AD 1294, when the region passed to a line of Muslim rulers. The most breathtaking display of architecture, sculpture, and painting in all India is found at Hyderabad in the ancient rock-sculpted caves of Ellora and Ajanta. The Kailasa at Ellora, a huge monolithic temple, possesses carved figures of gods, men and beasts in the stupendous proportions of a Michelangelo. Ajanta is the site of 25 monasteries and 5 cathedrals, all rock excavations supported by tremendous frescoed pillars on which artists and sculptors have immortalized their genius. Hyderabad city is graced by Osmania University and by the imposing Mecca Masjid Mosque, in which 10,000 Muslims assemble for prayer. Mysore State, 3,000 feet above sea level, abounds in dense tropical forests. The home of wild elephants, bison, bears, panthers and tigers. The two chief cities, Bangalore and Mysore, are clean and attractive, with many beautiful parks and public gardens. Hindu architecture and sculpture achieve their highest perfection in Mysore under the patronage of Hindu kings from the 11th to the 15th century. The temple at Belur, an 11th century masterpiece completed during the reign of King Vishnuvardhana, is unsurpassed in the world for delicacy of detail and exuberant imagery. The rock edicts found in northern Mysore date from the 3rd century BC. They illuminate the memory of King Asoka, whose vast empire included India, Afghanistan, and Baluchistan. Inscribed in various dialects, Asoka's sermons in stone bear witness to the widespread literacy of his day. Rock Edict 13 denounces wars. Consider nothing as true conquest save that of religion. Rock Edict 10 declares that a king's true glory depends on the moral progress he aids his people in attaining. Rock Edict 11 defines the true gift to be not goods, but good, the spreading of truth. On Rock Edict 6, the beloved emperor invites his subjects to confer with him on public business at any hour of the day or night, adding that by faithful discharge of his kingly duties, he was thus obtaining his own release from the debt he owed his fellow men. Asoka was a grandson of the formidable Chandragupta Maurya, who destroyed the garrisons left in India by Alexander the Great, and who, in 305 BC, defeated the invading Macedonian army of Seleucus. Chandragupta then received at his court in Pataliputra the Greek ambassador, Megasthenes, who had left us descriptions of the happy and enterprising India of his day. In 298 BC, the victorious Chandragupta handed over the reins of India's government to his son. Travelling to South India, Chandragupta spent the last 12 years of his life as a penniless ascetic, seeking self-realization in a rocky cave in Shravanabelagola, now a Mysore shrine. The same region boasts the world's largest statue, carved out of an immense boulder by the Jains in AD 983, to honor the sage Gomateswara. Interesting stories have been minutely recorded by Greek historians and others who accompanied or followed after Alexander in his expedition to India. The narratives of Arrian, Diodorus, Plutarch, and Strabo the geographer have been translated by Dr. J. W. McCrindle to throw a shaft of light on ancient India. The most admirable feature of Alexander's unsuccessful invasion was the deep interest he displayed in Hindu philosophy and in the yogis and holy men whom he encountered from time to time and whose society he eagerly sought. Shortly after the Western warrior arrived in Taxila in northern India, he sent Onisakritos, a disciple of the Hellenic school of Diogenes, to fetch a great sannyasi of Taxila, Dandamis. "Hail to thee, O teacher of Brahmins," Onisakritos said after seeking out Dandamis in his forest retreat. "The son of the mighty god Zeus, being Alexander, who is the sovereign lord of all men, ask you to go to him. If you comply, he will reward you with great gifts. If you refuse, he will cut off your head." The yogi received calmly this fairly compulsive invitation, and did not so much as lift up his head from his couch of leaves. "I am also a son of Zeus, if Alexander be such," he commented. "I want nothing that is Alexander's, for I am content with what I have. While I see that he wanders with his men over the sea and land for no advantage, and is never coming to an end of his wanderings. Go and tell Alexander that God, the supreme king, is never the author of insolent wrong, but is the creator of light, of peace, of life, of water, of the body of man and of souls. He receives all men when death sets them free, being then in no way subject to evil disease. He alone is the god of my homage, who abhors slaughter and instigates no wars. Alexander is no god, since he must taste of death," continues the sage in quiet scorn. "How can such as he be the world's master, when he has not yet seated himself on a throne of inner, universal dominion? Neither as yet has he entered living into Hades, nor does he even know the course of the sun over the vast regions of this earth. Most nations have not so much as heard his name." After this chastisement, surely the most caustic ever sent to assault the ears of the Lord of the world, the sage added ironically, "If Alexander's present dominions be not capacious enough for his desires, let him cross the Ganges River. There he will find a country able to sustain all his men." "The gifts Alexander promises are useless to me," Dandamis went on. "The things I prize and find of real worth are trees, which are my shelter, blooming plants, which provide my daily food, and water, which assuages my thirst. Possessions amassed with anxious thought are wont to prove ruinous to those who gather them, causing only the sorrow and vexation that afflict all unenlightened men. As for me, I lie upon forest leaves, and having nothing to guard, close my eyes in tranquil slumber, whereas, had I anything of worldly value, that burden would banish sleep. The earth supplies me with everything I need, even as a mother provides her child with milk. I go wherever I please, unencumbered by material cares. Should Alexander cut off my head, he cannot also destroy my soul. My head, then silent, and my body, like a torn garment, will remain on the earth, from which their elements were taken. I then, becoming spirit, shall ascend to God. He encloses us all in flesh, and put us on earth to prove whether, when here below, we shall live obedient to his ordinances. And he will require of us, when we depart hence, an account of our lives. He is the judge of all wrongdoing, the groans of the oppressed ordain the punishment of the oppressor. Let Alexander terrify with threats men who wish for wealth and who dread death. Against the Brahmins his weapons are powerless. We neither love gold nor fear death. Go then and tell Alexander this. Dandamis has no need of aught that is yours, and therefore will not go to you. And if you want anything from Dandamis, come you to him. Onesicritos duly conveyed the message. Alexander listened with close attention, and felt a stronger desire than ever to see Dandamis, who, though old and naked, was the only antagonist in whom he, the conqueror of many nations, had met more than his match. Alexander invited to Taxila a number of Brahmin ascetics, noted for their skill in answering philosophical questions with pithy wisdom. An account of the verbal skirmish is given by Plutarch. Alexander himself framed all the questions. Which be the more numerous, the living or the dead? The living, for the dead are not. Which breeds the larger animals, the sea or the land? The land, for the sea is only a part of land. Which is the cleverest of beasts? That one with which man is not yet acquainted. Man fears the unknown. Which existed first, the day or the night? The day was first by one day. This reply caused Alexander to betray surprise. The Brahmin added, "Impossible questions require impossible answers." How best may a man make himself beloved? A man will be beloved if, possessed with great power, he still does not make himself feared. How may a man become a god? By doing that which it is impossible for a man to do. Which is stronger, life or death? Life, because it bears so many evils. Alexander succeeded in taking out of India as his teacher, a true yogi. This man was Kalyana, Swami Sphines, called Kalanos by the Greeks. The sage accompanied Alexander to Persia. On a stated day, at Susa in Persia, Kalanos gave up his aged body by entering a funeral pyre in view of the whole Macedonian army. The historians record the astonishment of the soldiers as they observed that the yogi had no fear of pain or death. He never moved once from his position as he was consumed in the flames. Before leaving for his cremation, Kalanos had embraced many of his close companions, but had refrained from bidding farewell to Alexander, to whom the Hindu sage had merely remarked, "I shall see you later in Babylon." Alexander left Persia and, a year later, died in Babylon. The prophecy had been the Indian guru's way of saying that he would be present with Alexander in life and death. The Greek historians have left us many vivid and inspiring pictures of Indian society. Hindu law, Arian tells us, protects the people and ordains that no one among them shall, under any circumstances, be a slave, but that, enjoying freedom themselves, they shall respect the equal right to it that all men possess. The Indians, states another text, neither put out money at usury, nor know how to borrow. It is contrary to established practice for the Indians to do or to suffer a wrong. Therefore, they neither make contracts nor acquire securities. Healing, we are told, was by simple and natural means. Cures are effected rather by regulating diet than by the use of medicines. The remedies most esteemed are ointments and plasters. All others are considered to be in great measure pernicious. Engagement in war was restricted to the Kshatriyas, or warrior caste. Nor would an enemy, coming upon a husbandman at work on his land, do him any harm. For men of this class are regarded as public benefactors and are protected from all injury. The land, thus remaining unravaged and producing heavy crops, supplies the inhabitants with the requisites to make life enjoyable. The ubiquitous religious shrines of Mysore are a constant reminder of the many great saints of South India. One of these masters, Tayu Manavar, has left us the following challenging poem. You may control a mad elephant. You may shut the mouth of the bear and the tiger, ride the lion and play with the cobra. By alchemy you may earn your livelihood. You may wander through the universe incognito, make vassals of the gods, be ever youthful. You may walk on water and live in fire, but control of the mind is better and more difficult. In the beautiful and fertile state of Travancore, in the extreme south of India, where traffic is conveyed over rivers and canals, the Maharaja assumes every year a hereditary obligation to expiate the sin incurred by wars and the annexation in the distant past of several petty states to Travancore. For 56 days annually, the Maharaja visits the temple thrice daily to hear Vedic hymns and recitations. The expiation ceremony ends with the Lakshadipam, or illumination of the temple by 100,000 lights. Madras Presidency, on the southeast coast of India, contains the flat, spacious, sea-girt city of Madras, and Conjeeveram, the golden city, capital site of the Pallava dynasty, whose kings ruled during the early centuries of the Christian era. In modern Madras Presidency, the non-violent ideals of Mahatma Gandhi have made great headway. The white distinguishing Gandhi caps are seen everywhere. In the south generally, the Mahatma has effected many important temple reforms for untouchables, as well as caste system reforms. The origin of the caste system, formulated by the great legislator Manu, was admirable. He saw clearly that men are distinguished by natural evolution into four great classes: those capable of offering service to society through their bodily labour, sudras; those who serve through mentality, skill, agriculture, trade, commerce, business life in general; vaisyas; those whose talents are administrative, executive and protective, rulers and warriors, kshatriyas; those of contemplative nature, spiritually inspired and inspiring, brahmins. Neither birth, nor sacraments, nor study, nor ancestry can decide whether a person is twice born, i.e. a brahmin. The Mahabharata declares, character and conduct only can decide. Manu instructed society to show respect to its members insofar as they possessed wisdom, virtue, age, kinship, or lastly, wealth. Riches in Vedic India were always despised if they were hoarded or unavailable for charitable purposes. Ungenerous men of great wealth were assigned a low rank in society. Serious evils arose when the caste system became hardened through the centuries into a hereditary halter. India, self-governing since 1947, is making slow but sure progress in restoring the ancient values of caste, based solely on natural qualification and not on birth. Every nation on earth has its own distinctive misery-producing karma to deal with and honourably remove. India, with her versatile and invulnerable spirit, is proving herself equal to the task of caste reformation.
End of Disc 12. Chapter 41 continues on Disc 13.